the Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
And this is episode 262.
The Specter of a Meltdown.
That's right. This is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
Phil Parada.
And Tom Lawrence.
Yeah, so interesting news recently, just after the holidays, regarding processors.
Yeah.
And problems with processors.
Oh, so many problems.
Yeah. So
it's cross-platform, so we should talk about it, right?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
this is a hardware problem, so
mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah. It's the way the processor speculates. Should we do some catch-up real quick, or do we want to go right into this topic?
Why don't we save it for news, and okay. Then we'll mm-hmm. do some catch-up. So Mary, yeah. What'd you do?
So, well, I read a paper on the Spectre, and I did do that, but I'll save it. What did I do? Well, I'm grappling with my SSD on my computer, my workstation, my non-Linux workstation, it's as far as I'll go with it. Went down, and so I'm grappling with it, and I'm gonna probably hire a company, a well-known company, to help me with it. But anyway, so hopefully we'll get it cloned and get it fixed. So I was dealing with that. I was also playing around with, in KDE, the screenshot utility is called I think Spectacle. Is that right, Tom? What is the screenshot utility called in KDE?
I use Shutter.
Oh, really?
I know there's more than one. Shutter's been my favorite because it's the way it hooks into everything.
It is called Spectacle.
Okay.
And I don't know why, but for some reason, my system occasionally freezes when I use it, or what happens more frequently is I get a little error message when I close it down. So there's something's going on with it, but other than that, it works. So I started to look into other screenshot programs, and I came across a screenshot compositor called Genie. No, Screeny.
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 Okay.
Are you familiar with it?
I'm not. I'm interested, though.
What's kind of interesting is that you have a setup of these little boxes, and then you just simply drag your screenshots over to these boxes, and then you have controls where you can change the angle of the boxes. You can change where the boxes are relative to the other, where a box is relative to the other boxes in the composite layout. I was pretty impressed with it, so I had a bunch of little screenshots. I played around with it. It's very nice, and so then what it does is it will save it as. It saves it as a graphic so that you can then drop it into maybe a website or something like that. I haven't done, I didn't do a deep dive into it because I was ultimately looking for a screenshot program, not one that takes screenshots and arranges them. But I just happened to find that. So
that I like that a lot. That's that is superior to what Tom's been doing for a very long time.
Really? Really? Okay.
So you're installing it as we speak.
Oh, great, great.
It's Screeny-QT, apt-get install Screeny-QT.
There you go. Yeah, so anyway, I did install it, obviously, and it was kind of fun playing around with it. But I like the fact you can put shadows and kind of give depth, the perception of depth.
Yes.
So, or depth perception.
No, I like...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really... I'm looking at it going, wow. I didn't want to type my password, so I'm going to wait since I was like, whoa, caught myself. I'm so quick to.
We can always, shield it. But yeah. Anyway, so that's kind of what I did. And then of course there was the holidays and all that stuff. And
yeah.
Freezing stuff off.
Yeah,
freezing
it was
parts of my
cold.
Body off. I tell you.
Last night, yesterday morning, it was really cold. When it got down to -10 for us, right?
My ivy is going to get -7. Killed. I have ivy on a fence. And what I like about it is it shields, from view, from the street view. And about 4 years ago when we had that really cold winter, the ivy died. So it has taken 4 years to grow back up.
Oh,
I think the ivy maybe, well, we'll see. But anyway, so other than that, that's essentially what I did. And here we are.
All right.
What about you, Tony?
You have you heard of Calabra online?
Calabra, yes.
Yeah, it's kind of like Google Docs that you can, but it's open source. And I got it working with my Nextcloud.
Oh, awesome.
Cool.
So, yeah, so it's anytime you click on a document, Excel or .doc or the .dot.
Now, this is with your cloud at home.
Or, yeah, your, on my next on your, cloud at home.
Oh, okay.
How does the phone app work, or have you tried it?
I haven't tried it yet. Okay. But what's interesting to get it working, I guess it's so complex to try to get it working right, that they created a Docker image, and that's the instructions they give you. So I'm running a Docker image you know, on the same server that's running my next cloud. And then you put in a proxy, a web proxy that connects over to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me almost 3 or 4 hours to get it completely working perfect. But it's just because I had to go through and like turn off services and stuff to be able to get the Let's Encrypt cert to come down on the new
Okay.
for the new domain name, and then return it back on and or turn on my other stuff and. So it was just like a little convoluted, and I'll probably have to do it again in 3 months. And to do, I had to do it like the cert only manual way.
Yep, that's how we run issuance tests with cert only.
Oh yeah.
If you would like any help with that after the show, let me know.
Yeah,
I might know a guy or two.
Right. So that was the big thing that I did over the holiday weekend, other than presents and. Playing with the kids. And so, yeah.
Good.
Phil, what's up?
My wife and I are just about done closing on our house.
Excellent.
We got the paperwork sent over to the title company. We've got the home insurance policy. We've got our money waiting to be quickly flown out of our bank account.
Yep.
Home life stuff is going really well. I fixed up a bunch of cast iron pots and pans again through my electrolysis tank. That was a bunch of fun because science.
Yes.
And as far as work stuff has been going, we deployed Acme Staging version 2, which has wildcard support.
I was wondering when that was coming out.
For everybody who uses Let's Encrypt. That came out on... January 4th, and that was a bunch of fun.
Hey.
So that it's in production now?
It's in staging, should be in production end of February.
Awesome.
All right. So far, things are looking good. You can track Boulder on GitHub. It's pretty fun.
Cool.
How about you, Tom?
Boulder. Wait, what is Boulder?
Boulder is the Let's Encrypt CA and other software. Uh-huh. It's the application that we run. And when you get a certificate, you get it from Boulder.
Is it based out of Colorado?
It is not.
Oh, okay. I'm trying to figure out how Boulder figured into it.
Acme.
Oh.
Like yes. Looney Tunes.
Oh, Looney Tunes.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Gotcha. Coyote.
That's great.
Oh, nicely done.
Well, I'll follow up on that Let's Encrypt love. I moved over. So I've over the years, I've had a hosting company for a long time, but I've not really been pushing it. So now we're deciding to revive it and push it because I had some incidents with the previous hosting company. And they kept talking about for the last year offering Let's Encrypt. So I moved over to a new hosting company. Let's Encrypt comes default with every install. Matter of fact, they've absolutely done a wonderful job. When I set up a new website within the system, they just create it for you. Without asking.
Right,
you actually, by default, would have to turn it off. So, and they give you an option to turn it off if you want to replace it.
But who would want to do that?
Who would want to do that? So if you don't install an SSL, it automatically installs it for you within about 2 hours of the website being set up, which is really, they have a very nice automated system that works wonderful for it. So
very cool.
Big shout out to the guys over at A2 Hosting for developing that. That's, yeah. It's like, because at first I was like, how do you turn it on? And as I opened up a ticket, I'm like, oh, you just got to wait. But before they had a ticket within an hour, like, you didn't wait long enough. And I'm like, I looked, I'm like, oh, it's already there. I thought you
Can you say the name of the company?
Well, no, A2 Hosting.
Oh, did you say that?
Yeah, I said, shout out to A2 Hosting. Okay. No, they're I'm really happy with them. Their support's
I must have been reading.
Yeah.
I like them. That's where SMLR has been for the last 4 years. And
We've had very little problem with them.
Right.
Yeah. We bought a bigger reseller account with them and set it up. Because it's not really worth it. Some people are like, oh, do you have your own data center? I'm like, it's just too much work. Our angle on hosting is not to be the cheapest hosting. It's to be, you can call
the
us.
Best.
Well, the best. You can call us. We'll offer you help. We will walk you through things. A lot of people just want their website hosted, not a lot of details. But if you're looking for a bargain basement cheap web host, sorry, that's not – Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not us. That's not our market. So there's plenty of people offering hosting for $2.99 a month or something ridiculous. Yeah. But you want nice SSL and everything else. But back to other things that I did.
Oh, yes.
Holidays, kids, you know, all that fun stuff. But Zen Server. So I'm a big fan, and I did all this great YouTube videos on Citrix Zen Server and entire virtualization mm-hmm. tutorials and everything else, and it's become really popular. But then Zen Server decided, Citrix decided, I should say, because they took over the kind of the Zen open source project, and what they do is they compile it but add a few closed source things in there and features, which is fine because they make kind of a cool interface for it. They decided to, when they went from 7.3 or 7.2 to 7.3 version, to remove a bunch of features that were all in there already. So they took away the HA and some of the other stuff, and they're like, you have to buy licenses. Yeah.
I'm shaking my fist.
Yes.
You can take my HA from my cold dead admin hand.
So this is where things get fun. Tom did a rant video on it. The rant video got popular, and Citrix watched my rant video, and a project manager from Citrix reached out to me. And they said they're really looking at the community feedback, and I replied, backlash, you mean? And we were absolutely snarky, but he took it all in stride, realizes that this is a big concern. Mm-hmm. But then the people over at Zen Orchestra, who make a web interface to go on top of Zen, they retweeted my stuff. Then they came up with their own idea. They're reviving the original Zen open source project, and they're going to take it, they're forking it from Citrix and coming up with their own and putting some stuff behind it. So they're going to put all the features that Zen took out and then add more and go full web interface as opposed to the Windows interface. So that's been kind of exciting, interacting with all those people. Like, I'm part of something. It's exciting. And
yeah, that's
people,
great.
Yeah. So I said, I even said I'll even help with documentation. I'll contribute because I'm not a coder. Because they're looking for, they have like four people that are really good coders on there, but they're looking for other help. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned them that I'll help with documentation. I'll even create some videos and tutorials on the whole project. So that's exciting.
Now, just to be clear, because I'm a little bit confused, which is my own problem. The Zen Orchestra team is going to take the Linux Foundation sponsored Zen source code and then basically do the same thing that Citrix is doing.
Yeah. Essentially,
okay,
like that.
I gotcha.
Yep, they're gonna kind of they're reviving it. It's called Zen. It's called like the Zen NG project. It's on their Twitter, and it's cool.
Cool, thanks.
It's all open source, all on GitHub. Zen Orchestra is one of the contributors. They found other contributors as well, so it's not just them. But they obviously, being Zen Orchestra and writing a web interface, have intimate knowledge of how it works, so they're already very familiar with the base.
If you've never used Zen Orchestra, it's really, really nifty.
It is.
It runs in your browser. You don't have to run a Windows VM to manage your Zen box if you don't want to do a command line style.
They've done a really top-notch job for doing it, so it's a really cool project. I think that's the – last thing I did was I did an entire open source, and I'm going to turn this into a talk at PenguinCon. I did a open source video editing video. Mm-hmm. It's the entire open source tool stack I use and process we use for editing videos, which is Kdenlive, OBS, Audacity, and just all the things we use to do the open source.
Speaking of that, I saw, and I thought of you immediately, I saw an article I interpreted it as a New Year's resolution for OpenShot. They vowed to crash less this year.
All right.
So, yeah, which kind of cracked me up. In 2018, they vowed to crash less.
I've been trying, because this is the common question. So I've got several tutorials on Kdenlive. Mm-hmm. I haven't done any in OpenShot since I moved to Kdenlive. Yeah. But OpenShot's come a long way. They've enhanced and added a mm-hmm. lot of the features, but they're still missing some of the features I really need. But everyone asks me, how do I run these on Windows? And Kdenlive and OpenShot both have Windows versions. They're both horrible. They crash a lot. If it would just render one single video,
why do I not feel bad about that?
Yeah. My answer to my because it's the most common comment is, how do I get this working properly under Windows? Because they do have an instruction, mm-hmm. and I'm like, sorry, I'm a tech guy who has put 45 minutes in time into my wife's laptop and who runs Windows on it, and I cannot get it to work properly. Not without crashing, not without aggravating. My wife started a YouTube channel as well, mm-hmm. and she wanted to use the same tools I'm using because I can help her with them, but I've given up. I have. We got it to work on one computer. We don't know why. It works on Steve's computer. Won't work on my wife's computer. And running the same version of Windows. And I even tried it in a virtual machine. It runs worse and won't even open.
Oh, that's really yeah. That's very strange.
A shoddy craftsman always blames his tools, but this Windows.
This Windows. Yeah. No real craftsman should run Windows. We'll just leave it at that.
and your comment, Tommy, again, makes me think about this past weekend. Well, actually, we're still in the weekend, so it's not past, but... There's an open source screenshot tool available in Windows called GreenShot. And I don't know if you guys have ever heard of it.
I don't use Windows. Sorry.
Well, and the only reason why I do is because of my financial markets platform. Okay. That's the only reason. But there's this great – it's an open source tool called GreenShot. And I thought, man. And again, that was all part of that whole screenshot thing I went through. So I thought, wow, I wonder if I can get this to run in Linux. So I made an attempt, and it did not work. Apparently some files missing. But here's the thing. Their FAQ says, GreenShot is written with the Microsoft .NET framework, which does not run on Linux or iOS systems. And so I'm thinking, wait a minute, .NET Core or whatever. And they said, although Microsoft released .NET Core, which is multi-platform, unfortunately .NET Core does neither support Windows Forms nor WPF. Which would make it impossible to reuse GreenShot's existing code base. So they don't want to maintain multiple code bases.
Right.
But I thought, wow, if we ever get a chance to talk to those .NET Core guys, there's a question for them. So.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing is wouldn't work, and probably it's part of one of those two parts, is they said most GUI things don't work.
Yeah, that's heavily GUI.
Yeah.
But what's... pretty cool about it is that you can take a screenshot and you can automatically send it to Dropbox and you can do this, that, and the other. It's really pretty cool.
All right.
Anyway, so sorry. Didn't mean to hijack that, but made me think of it.
No problem.
So anything more, Tom? I promise I won't hijack your company.
No, it's fine. I launched a new company, but that's not as relevant to any of this. So I'm doing social media marketing under its own name and stuff. So I've been busy with all of that. Been busy, which is good.
It is good.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. No, I think that's all.
It.
Because I talked about virtualizing my home last time, so that's still going well. Nothing's broke. Virtualized PF Sense works well.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Once, yeah, and that's another tutorial I'm going to do because a lot of people ask that about how to virtualize your firewall and the methods and yeah, I'm working on that video still. Mm-hmm. That's going to be done hopefully next week.
Well, I think that'll be an interesting one.
Well, there's things I did. I'm going to go in depth on a security assurance of why it's virtualized at home, where I'm less worried about someone breaching a firewall, but definitely I like it hardware firewall here. I feel comfortable with that. So, but for home people,
yeah, it's good enough. you're not a high profile target necessarily.
No, but I don't run any IoT stuff anyways. That's a whole other topic.
Right. So actually, that's what I've been doing at home,
Alexa.
The last few days is. Tweaking my firewall rules so that when I get a couple IoT things, then I can have it just plug right in.
You may have noticed we have another network here. If you look at our Wi-Fi, called Internet of Insecure Things, and we misspelled stuff, and it's funny. People like, you misspelled things, and I'm like, well, it wasn't an accident, but now it like secure is misspelled. I'm like, because it's not secure. That's my excuse for misspelling the word secure.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting. And then I'm looking at getting a Ubiquiti AP access point. So
we get them cheap. So and eventually, because we're working on getting sponsors from them, we get more free stuff from them.
Awesome.
Oh, I'm wearing I found fingerprints in a firewall, or I'm sorry, in one of the switches, because I take things apart for my YouTube videos. And they sent us shirts and swag, and they sent us a really high-end Ubiquiti AP unit, too. So we're hoping to get fully on their sponsored list, which means we'll get lots of free stuff.
Awesome.
And nice. I'll let my friends help demo it. So
hey.
I run the APACLRs, one in my house and one in my garage.
That was the one I was looking at getting.
They're really, really nice.
They are.
Yeah. Never had a problem so far.
And if you want to borrow one, you can literally just borrow one if you want. I have one just sitting open because we lost the box to it.
Yeah,
well, I know where the box went, but that's a different story.
All right.
Good.
Very cool. Well, we should probably move on
to
feedback.
We want to hear from you. Call 734-258-7009 or email show at smlr.us with your feedback and questions.
All right, so feedback. I think we got two emails about net neutrality since the last show. They were both on Christmas Eve.
So, see what people were waiting for Santa?
I think, yeah. And right, while you're pulling it up, because I remember the email, I don't remember who sent it, but I remember the email was a different organization besides the government running it. I think that's an interesting concept because you do have, ICANN is not a government institute directly. And I think there's some merit to it. It's rare, but here's something a lot of people don't know here in the U.S. If I say something's UL listed, which I see that tag on even things around mm-hmm. here on adapters, mm-hmm. you assume UL is a government entity. They're not. UL is an independent lab that mm-hmm. came up with certification that everyone kind of adopted. So there is precedence for it to happen, and people almost assume some of these companies are somehow have government affiliations, but they actually don't. So there is a concept of that, but how do we – it's the weird – thought process of how do you grant authority to it for enforcement? Because UL listing, is a, for example, is also a voluntary thing, not a thing where someone has to adhere to it. So the people prefer mm-hmm. it. When you're dealing with monopolies in the ISP market, we need some enforcement because I don't know if you've seen, but they have further eroded things. They changed the broadband requirements. That's part of the new proposal.
Mm.
What new proposal?
For the way they're doing the net neutrality.
In net neutrality?
What they determine is broadband. They're reducing the speeds that are which broadband. I think it's down to...
Hooray.
300 baud?
Yeah.
No!
There used to be two requirements. There used to be a 25 down, 4 up, or more was considered broadband. They're reducing that. They're also removed the clause that it has to have a certain price point. So even if you had to pay $10,000 a month for it, which in some places you have to pay a lot because of the rural area, then it still doesn't matter. It's still available. So the availability listing had to be a 25 and 4 and be affordable, so to speak. And I forget what the guidelines for affordable were, but they were a lot less than what they are now because they removed the entire affordable. Mm-hmm. So as long as there's some price tag that can be attached to it, that becomes available. So they want to Ooh. Broaden the scope because right now less than 50% of the has access to broadband at all. Mm. Less than 50% of the U.S. does. Mm-hmm. So they want to broaden that further, and it's going to look like 80% just by a law change, 80 or 90% of the U.S. has access to broadband, if not 100% with the guidelines being reduced. So that's an interesting side note to it. So I don't know how this can be enforced from a non-government entity. I know that was the whole –
Well, you know,
I'm addressing the feedback, but maybe Tony found it.
It's just all part of making America great again. Yeah. I mean, it's good, you know, doing things.
Mm-hmm.
I'll end it on that.
Yeah,
it's pretty close. Yeah, I mean, it was. So there was two of them. One was about the, you know, how does it have legally affected, but then the other one was, who should be setting the regulations?
Right.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a mess.
Lobbyists? No. Oh, wait, that's how it's done now.
Yeah, it is how it's done now. Yeah, it's kind of a mess. I will note, I don't mind. I'll even throw money at Netflix and some love there. Did you see Netflix New Year's resolution?
Mm-mm. No, I missed it.
Oh, yeah, they had a tweet that's hysterical. It says, "We stand united with the world for net neutrality, and for UFCC, see you in court in 2018. I'm like, oh, that's pretty
okay,
good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. So any other bits of feedback?
We had two more on the website, and one about related with the Arch Labs Linux. He says, still not fixed.
Huh?
Tom fixed it.
Yeah, we were talking about it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I actually changed it to be Arch Labs Linux instead of because I couldn't find the Shark one. So there's, yeah, that's just a mess.
Okay, so we're all set.
It is. Yeah, it says Arch Labs even though I don't. Yeah, sorry.
With the SD card file got corrupted, so.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm going to pull it off YouTube because I don't have any idea. I should have consulted with you people. Sometimes Tom thinks he's smart and he's not. This is how Tom learns. I make assumptions.
Well, we all do, but the file good news is
I've done everything I can. I never thought to ask for
well,
help.
We're going to implement Plan B, so.
Yes. Humble Tom Moore. my wife will be thrilled to know. She maybe will be listening and say, "You admitted you're wrong. When are you going to do that for me?" Anyways.
All right.
Let's get back on topic.
Right. And then there's one other comment about your review for Arch Labs. And he just says how there's a few things, the package manager and something else, have how it's not ready for prime time. And, you know, is why spend time on a distro that's not going to be ready.
Why, you know, oh, as a person to use time?
It. No, not you. He's not going to spend time trying that if it's not going to be ready for a while. So,
yeah, sometimes what I try to do when I select a distro is I prefer to have a production ready one, but sometimes there'll be something about a distro that it's close, maybe it's a release candidate, but there may be some interesting aspect to it that I want to talk about or I want to experiment with, and then I end up working with it enough that it, in my mind, it becomes kind of a review. So
yeah,
you know, but anyway.
All right. That was all that I saw.
And then something cool. So viewers, so people who go to smlr.us, our website, I'm working on a little script to pull some stats from archive.org. And then I'm going to throw that through GNUplot so we can see trends from all the episodes. I think that would be pretty nifty.
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That'd be cool.
Phil asked me a question, and now we went on a mission. One question was, how do we pull stats? I heard you could, and Phil's been plugging away for a while now.
Why?
Like an hour, because which is
math.
A long time in Phil time.
Because math. Oh, yeah. The universal language. I love it.
Phil types fast, so there's like a whole lot of code written in the last hour.
That's right. You know, when you don't hear Phil talking, he's coding. Yeah.
Well, your first 10,000 lines are never good.
First 10,000. All right. So any other feedback, or was that pretty much it?
That's all I saw, unless something from you guys.
No. I didn't see anything else.
All right.
Okay.
Then I guess we're moving on to distros.
Distro Fever, where we cover the latest hot distro releases and news.
Right. There's a few interesting ones I saw come up. IPFire is a release.
Yes.
So if you're running that as a firewall, then make sure you get updated.
I think that's something exciting.
I saw that.
Is just all the development going on into firewalls as a whole, software-based firewalls. I'm like that hipster. I was doing it before it was cool. I mean, my first, I want to say it was a fork of the Mandrake OS. I used to run a open source firewall back in 2001 before I moved to IPCOP, because it predated IPCOP. It was like 2000 or 2001. Then I moved to IPCOP, which I always liked, which probably I'm guessing IPFire is related or a fork of.
It is. It's a... Yeah, it's a fork of IPCOP, because IPCOP wasn't updated for like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I know. They didn't touch it. The project kind of abandoned. Right. And then I moved into pfSense, and I've been really happy.
Right.
People keep wanting me to try. There's a fork of pfSense, and there's a mm-hmm. ton of controversy with it, a whole lot, including court cases and everything with OpenSense.
Ah, okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the OpenSense is a fork
because they
of
did not adhere to the tenets of the open of the GPL.
They seem to have childish infighting as well. The people making fun of them. Matter of fact, the pfSense people were directly making fun of the OpenSense people, and every time they have a flaw, tweeting like these guys are a bunch of idiots that don't know what they're doing.
That's not cool.
Mm. But apparently there's all kinds of difference of opinion because pfSense is funded by Netgate, the hardware manufacturer,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't like that. So the OpenSense, and this I understand the whole gist of it, they partnered with another hardware company that's going to fund theirs.
Interesting.
But they were more interested in selling hardware than security, so their security flaws got highlighted a lot by the pfSense people.
That's never good.
This is, but it turned devolved into debauchery and just and childish behavior. That's the best. I've read some of it, including setting up a website that looks like OpenSense. That's not. It's a fake website that makes fun of them. So,
oh my goodness!
Because they bought the domain like OpenSense.com. So there was an entire lawsuit over this.
Oh,
I
wow.
tried to follow the drama as people wanted me to cover it. I'm like, I can't even sort this out because it's all speculation of who actually registered anything. Because everything was registered anonymously, so we don't know.
Yeah.
It suspects that these people from pfSense were acting childish. The developers, I don't know. Anyways, as much as I know about the drama, I can't make any clear assessments of who's actually at fault. I like pfSense. The product is solid. Mm-hmm. And I got to admit, people who are writing code for firewalls and doing historically a good job of security, it takes a certain type of person to be able to do that. And I'm going to deal with the fact that they probably have outlashes when people try to mm-hmm. call them out on things.
Sure.
So.
Sure.
Not that I'm justifying their behavior, but I'm just going to say we see it. I mean, we're going to look at Linus. He's a kernel developer. The guy's wicked smart. Mm-hmm. And his tongue lashing on this Intel Meltdown thing is hysterical.
Oh, it was fantastic. I've got it pulled up right in front of me.
Yeah, we will cover it in the news section before I get too off topic. Other distros.
Farron OS looks interesting. It's based on Linux Mint.
Funny you say that. I downloaded it, and really? There could very well be a review of it coming.
All right.
Actually, I've started working on it.
Sweet. Mm-hmm. All right, so it won't be it'll be probably in a month or something it'll come out.
Yeah, yep, a few weeks.
Awesome.
So.
Yeah, I think it's because of the holidays. There's not a big list of new distros. Some people took the holidays off for writing something. Matter of fact, outside of security updates, I want to say, because I do all daily package update notices, I don't think I've hardly seen any package updates that weren't security related. And there were very few of them, because the hackers took some holiday too.
Well, speaking, I'm going to push this up from the news segment to distros because it's applicable, but it looked like you can now download 1710. You know, remember the Lenovo? There was the I think the October release of Ubuntu, or at least Kubuntu did it. It was creating problems with the BIOS and Lenovo desktops, and I think they've got that fixed. And so you can now I saw an article.
Well, it's much worse than that. It was Ubuntu was corrupting BIOSes on UEFI,
and you couldn't.
Right,
it's like breaking
because
it
looks specifically, and it's mm-hmm. called. I want to say it's called Linspire. It is a BIOS manufacturer, and it's hard to find this information as to who's actually using it. They know the problem, so they know if you have a BIOS that's built on this, mm-hmm. You will have a problem. The problem comes in if you try to run multi-boot or if the UEFI is set to look for a certain file. So there's some workarounds for it. So it doesn't destroy the BIOS. I don't believe it bricks the machine. I believe, though, the UEFI is hard-coded to look for a Windows boot path in the UEFI path. So you have to do some tweaking to get rid of it. But because the way mm-hmm. UEFI interacts with the OS, it can push those settings into the BIOS and screw things up. Hmm. So it's a pain. I read the whole debrief on it, and I'm like, what a disaster. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to get a good list because the manufacturers don't list. They'll say that I'm using a Lenovo here, and it says it has a UEFI BIOS, but they don't tell me who actually wrote the firmware for it. So if you have one written by that company, which
Yeah, and just to clarify, they are going to have those available this coming week.
Yeah,
just to, I may have given the impression that they're already available, but that was incorrect.
We can we get to an open source BIOS because that's I know there's a project mm-hmm. Plenty of projects that do this.
I believe
yes, Libre Boot. That's the name I was looking for. But we need stuff like that because we literally had to did it brick your computer? Well, I know who wrote your BIOS. I mean,
and apparently part of that bug was that users were locked out of their BIOS settings.
Yes,
and it would make
there was someone you had to
it would make their systems unbootable even if the image were booted in live mode.
Yeah,
so it was kind of a mess.
we really need
but I know
this.
It's been talked about.
UEFI is awful. We have a great dislike for many reasons.
Mm-hmm. So, and then what I also noticed on the DistroWatch page was that I think the rights to the name Linspire and FreeSpire were just sold.
Really?
Yeah.
Was that where did you see that at? It's on the DistroWatch?
I went to distrowatch.com. Yeah, I think it was there. Unless I dreamt it.
I don't know. Did you see Calculate Linux is on there? So you can have Gen 2. I could run Gen 2 and have Cinnamon Desktop running.
Yeah, here it is, FreeSpire. They announced the organization has purchased the rights to the commercial Linspire distribution and its community branch, FreeSpire. I went up to their website, and for under $10, you can buy Linspire, which has some additional capabilities, including, they said, and I don't know the degree to which this has been implemented, but support for ZFS. So I thought that was kind of interesting because ZFS is a very superior file management. Well, it's more than just that.
It's a file system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Very cool.
Yeah, so I saw that. It might be kind of fun to take a look at FreeSpire, too, as a review. Or even just pay the $7 and download Linspire, Also, RoboLinux. RoboLinux first hit the scene back in 2014, and And I think I took a look at it back then. And one of the attractive things about it is that they had a series of links in the menu that if, for example, you had a Broadcom wireless card and your card was not immediately recognized, you could click the link in the menu. It would reach out to the RoboLinux website and then download the whatever the driver files you needed and then install it with the idea that then you could access or at least turn on your wireless and have it working properly. I thought that was a very, from my perspective, it was a very ingenious way to accomplish these kinds of things. So RoboLinux is really, they were releasing every couple months, and then we get to 2016. I think they maybe had a couple of releases. Last year they had one release, and this year they've got another release. So they've really slowed as far as the frequency with which they're releasing their distro updates.
Well, if there's nothing broke, then what do they need to fix?
Well, there's always that perspective. Yeah, that's a good point, Tony. I'll give you that. No, I'll give you a lot.
Did you see Gecko Linux?
I did, and I didn't know if that was that was designed for insurance companies or what.
Geico. No. So it's based on OpenSUSE, mm-hmm. but it has all the non-free repositories too. So you can...
all the stuff people like. But, So it's a safe bet that this will not be on Richard Stallman's computer. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. No, I did see that. It's been around for a little while. They've got quite a few flavors of it. And I think you can, they've got it from both the Tumbleweed, which is the rolling release, and then Static, which is the standard SUSE.
All right.
So, Tom, you were going to say something.
I'm going to add, I just found something I'm adding. I refreshed a page, now I'm adding it to our news.
Oh.
It's related to our discussion we're going to have.
All right.
Someone just released a proof of concept on the ARM processor for the Meltdown.
All right.
They got a GitHub link and how to compile it.
Wow. Well, good. We'll look forward to talking about that.
Yeah, that's in our news section. So
it just... Right.
So any other distros? Because we could be getting to news pretty quickly.
Yeah. At least I didn't. Nothing else jumped out at me.
No, I was fairly quiet.
If you are in the Docker container space, Rancher OS had a new release just after Christmas. Rancher OS, for those of you that don't know, it provides a very nice GUI that you can drag and drop a network diagram for containers and have these containers such as Apache or Nginx or MySQL or Redis or Postgres, blah, 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 get spun up and networked for you just by dragging and dropping.
Awesome.
Really?
So when you're trying to herd all those Docker images, then that's...
Yep, it could help. I used it many, many moons ago, and it was pretty nifty. And they're still working on it, so good for them. It has a really interesting deploy feature and rollback feature if a deploy fails.
Oh.
And I thought that was pretty sweet.
Yeah, that's nice.
Nice.
Yeah, talk about another distro that I saw an article on. I was gonna talk about this in the news, but I think it makes sense to talk about it in distros. And that I think a couple episodes ago we talked about Amazon Linux releasing version 2, and of course I had never heard of Amazon Linux, and it was optimized for. Well, running in Amazon's cloud, but also it was interesting because this new version, it's based on RHEL.
Hmm.
And so, anyway, they're putting it out there as an enterprise version. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this proceeds.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you turn away from your mic, it gets quiet.
Oh, so if I do like this?
Yeah. You don't have to look at me. I won't feel gypped if you don't look at me.
All right.
I look at the mic. Because no one listening to us, except for people watching
that's
us.
That's true. Yeah, you guys count. Tony, you're getting the back of my head, darn it. but anyway, I was just trying to be polite. But it is based on RHEL, and then it uses RPM packages and also a modified version of Yellow Dog Updater and the other Red Hat tools. So I guess we'll see. But So Red Hat, you know, they had a very profitable quarter last quarter. I think they exceeded, then shot up.
Yep.
So, all right, that's really all I had for distros.
All right.
And news. No, and just kidding. I got more.
All right, well, I guess moving on to news.
Tech news and views.
So who wants to go first?
So we'll cover everything that's not Meltdown related first. I think just we'll set the bar for that. Because we're going to have a Meltdown on Meltdown.
Yeah, I have actually a story that could be a perfect segue into the whole Meltdown chip thing. So okay. Maybe I'll save that for, that'll be our segue into it. One thing I wanted to mention, I was out at Extreme Tech, and for some reason they had just an interesting assortment of articles, a couple of which I thought merited discussion today. One of them was the Windows Hello facial recognition, and this is actually from the 1,000 or no, I have that wrong. I couldn't even say my little joke right, but anyway, it's from the a picture is worth 1,000 logins department, and that's, as I said, Windows Hello facial recognition is bypassed with a photo. And what they did is they took kind of an infrared photo of the person, and they have a video on the Extreme Tech's website in this article, embedded in this article, that shows the process they went through. Now, and it was really fun to watch because they held the picture up to the laptop, and boom, you were in. Mm. Now they said that it has been fixed. In recent builds of Windows 10, Microsoft has added an anti-spoofing feature that prevents this photo workaround. However, it won't protect everyone. As the company that discussed this points out, not all users have upgraded Windows 10, because you know how some people are, like myself, if I'm using Windows 10, which is not all that frequently. You just turn off that because you want to control your updates. I don't want automatic. But anyway, so they said in corporate IT departments, they don't automatically have those updates. Those get pushed out by the IT department.
Yeah, based on their approval
imaged
basis.
Out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, precisely. So really, it may be available, but whether it's implemented across the board is another question.
And this is a reminder, passwords should be something you have. Biometrics are something you are. So mm-hmm. It is, and it's uniquely, you can't wait. I'm going to get plastic surgery because someone cloned my face. Got to change my password. Break my nose.
Yeah. So, all right. Looking good. Yeah. to make this camera or this photo, they went and got an infrared camera for about $50. And this picture is really kind of interesting. It's kind of got that, not that greenish background, but that kind of pinkish background anyway. Mm. So that was one that I thought was kind of interesting. Let's see, you talked about Red Hat already. I think we already talked about the release Canonical. That was in my news, but we got pushed that up. The other thing I wanted to mention too is that we've heard about all the devices that are susceptible to Spectre and Meltdown. Do you know what devices are immune? Anyone? Anyone?
Nokia phones.
AMD.
Anyone?
No, I don't.
All Raspberry Pi devices are immune to the Meltdown and Spectre vulnerabilities.
Let's just run the cloud on Raspberry Pis.
This was from an article in Softpedia, January 5th. So I don't know if that's changed at all, but Eben Upton. Confirmed today, it was I think Friday, that none of the Raspberry Pi devices wait a minute, how did they write this? Here's what the first paragraph says. They confirmed that none of the Raspberry Pi devices are not affected. So if none are not affected, that means they're all affected, but the headline says they're immune. I believe that was a mistype.
What's the processor in a Raspberry Pi?
So in the Pi 1 through 3, they use
ARM 1176.
ARM 11 for the Pi 1, then the Cortex A7 mm-hmm. for the Pi 2, and Cortex A53 for the Pi 3. And none of those are in the affected core list.
Yes, the cores are ATX, A57, and A72 are affected. So.
Yeah. So that was whoever typed that first paragraph. They had too many negatives in there.
For now. Once someone's down the path, someone's going to figure it out.
Yeah, I'm sure that they will.
Last week, you know what you would have found? none of them are affected.
Right you are, Tom. Right you are. Right you are. So I guess we'll find out. But as of Friday when they published this article, this poorly written intro paragraph, they weren't. Let's see. I think I want to say I think those are the items. I've got that one other item.
Someone commented that TrueOS is not effective. If you're not familiar with it, it runs everything in Ring Zero with no internet access.
TempleOS?
Temple, I'm sorry, Temple. TempleOS is not. Yeah. I said true.
TempleOS?
TempleOS isn't effective. Go look at it sometime if anyone's curious. It's not a distro any one of us are likely to run. Because we're like, we need to connect to things.
All right. I'll pass the baton to one of my podcasting colleagues.
Yeah, you know what I did find? You know, a month ago we
What did you find?
A month ago we talked about Linux Journal.
Yes.
I see. They are not closing.
Mm-hmm. They're not?
Linux Journal 2.0. So they got a
infusion
sponsorship,
of
yep, from the PIA. Private Internet Access Group.
Oh, that must be,
I bet love you, those people.
I bet you my subscription put them over the top. I'll take no credit for that, though.
Thank you very much, though.
It's funny. I got a discussion in my forums yesterday about PIA making some mm-hmm. new – as I made the videos for PIA on how to set up a PFSense to do your whole home network. And I may do some more videos on PIA because, one, they're probably one of the more open people, and they actively take the money they make from things and sponsor – well, this is another sponsor, but they did the source code audit for OpenVPN. They sponsored and funded the entire – they put some dollars behind it to do that, to have an entire security team pour through the latest code. So it went through code review. And what's nice is they're not doing it and keeping it for some type of closed source client that they run. They did it for the open source everything. And they're very, very open as a company, which I appreciate. So
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So PIA, I've been recommending it more, if not just because of other VPN companies, but the fact that they're actually supporting open source projects, not just doing it. So it's not just about security. It's about the fact that they actually put their money where their mouth is.
And I was impressed. I was impressed with how easy it was to put it on my Linux machine, put it on my Windows machine. I mean, it just works. It's great. Very easy to access. And you can, and I'm sure probably other programs are like this, but you can, via the pop-up menu, when I right-click on it, you can control where you connect from, or you can just let the system automatically connect you, which typically for me was out of Chicago. So I had a Chicago IP address.
They also do things like they're very open about this. If you would like to run torrents, here's the recommended countries you should run them in. They are like exceedingly open. They don't hint around or beat around the bush. Like maybe if you wanted to do a thing, they are very clear on how you do things. They are also one of the only ones I'm aware of, and there may be another company I'm just not aware of, but they offer port forwarding on this. They have an API interface for high-level ports, so you can open up certain ports to your VPN, so you can actually run like an anonymous server inside there. Which, that's interesting. Apparently their API has gotten... I didn't realize how advanced it was because I covered it before when I did a review of their product. Apparently, it's gotten substantially better. So where they have a whole command line interface to Linux, so you can actually interact with it better. I'm gonna be taking a look at it, and I'm excited. That's kind of cool.
Do you guys have any numbers as far as what – because typically, you know, if you connect through a VPN, I mean, that's just another little layer.
Yeah.
Have you – any numbers as far as the performance hit that
I'm impressed. They're upfront about the
speed.
Not
just about them, but in general. Is there some kind of a rule of thumb that you can expect a 2% or 3%?
It's pretty minor. I was actually shocked at how minor the hit is. But a lot of times they have their own rate limiting. So you're actually you face their rate limiting because they can't just give you that much bandwidth because it would cause problems. So they're upfront about it. Like you don't care how fast your connection is. We're rate limiting this particular node to 25, and they have the speeds listed per node.
Because I get market data streams, and what I've found this is during the day, of course, when it's really busy. So what I found is I unhook that VPN when I'm getting all that because I noticed it was a little slower. Not that not that it's a huge deal, but on my Linux machine, it doesn't matter because I'm usually using that at night. So.
You know, the only problem I've come up with is I went to log into the university and they block that kind of connections from anonymized IPs.
Yep. That's actually become an issue where Netflix knows all PIA's ones and they've been blocking all of them. So if you come from one of their IP blocks, they know what they are. That's become a whole other issue with the internet. It's like, cool, VPNs, all these companies are now blocking them. So I ran into that problem doing testing because people are like, well, you don't run it all the time. I'm like, I can't. I mean, it just breaks things. So now that's where I'm making more videos on how to segment your network. So you're, for example, anything you want to connect to Netflix, you want to put on non-PIA.
Sure.
Then your other surfing you put on air. But you're finding more and more sites that block it. So I don't even – it's an aggravation. We want to be anonymous, but we can't. And now the ISPs can sell our data. It's a mess.
Yep.
All right, moving on.
It's okay. They'll just charge us more. Oh, wait.
And then I found the article about running Collabra online in your Nextcloud. So,
what is Collabra online? For those of us who don't know,
it's like Google Docs. So it's a web-based or HTML5 office suite.
Yeah.
So you can, it's not quite full like OpenOffice, but it, it supports the OpenOffice and the Microsoft Office file formats, and you can open it up and edit, and I believe it does. Yeah, multiple.
Yes.
Oh, that's
collaboration.
Really nice.
I've done testing with it. I really like it. I just haven't tested the apps with it, but my problem with getting off Google Docs often comes down to the apps. We use the apps on our phone a lot.
Where do you download this from, or how do you get the capability? Just go to a.
So you have to have a Nextcloud server running.
Oh well, there I'm out of there.
Right. So all right. It's not for everybody, but for small businesses, this is awesome because you have Nextcloud, it's like Dropbox, running in your own office. And that's how I use it mainly is I have a couple folders that are synced back to my server and that's my backup,
You can go to, and I'll throw this in the show notes if you haven't already, it's nextcloud.com/Collabra Online.
Yep.
It's an extension
right
to Nextcloud. It's built on top of that.
Yep. And so basically what it is Collabra Online runs in its own Docker image. It runs in a separate server-ish, kind of thing. And then you have to take Apache and do a HTTPS proxy over to the Collabra Online. And then when you point Nextcloud to that URL, where that other server is running, and then Nextcloud, then every time you go to open up a Word doc, it opens it up in that instance, that's that software that's running on the Docker.
Cool.
Yeah. In the directions, it says to go through and, because it's a HTTPS proxy to, you have to have a cert for that other one. So it's one more step, go through and set it up. And I did with I said it earlier.
We were talking and you used a CertBot to do that.
Yes. Yep.
Cool.
Exactly. And I have CertBot right here, right? That's
yeah.
It. Yeah.
For those of you listening just to the audio, he's got a little EFF CertBot sticker on his laptop.
I do not.
Mary.
Yes. Courtesy
Phil usually shows up with pockets full of stickers when he gets here.
Yeah. Right.
He distributes stickers among us.
Yeah, it's great.
That's why his laptop has the most stickers.
Am I catching up?
You
have a larger laptop, but...
I was going to have another one, but I can't find the link for it now. So if I find it, I'll let you guys know.
All right, that sounds good.
That's our hacker cred or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, that's it.
Very cool.
So, all right. Phil, so do you have any news to talk about?
The Acme staging version 2. I have been pretty much heads down writing a bunch of... support code to get that all working, and had a bunch of help from the team. So I'm really, really proud of that. It was impressive to see everybody on the team come together and help out in every way that they did. It felt like a big family.
That's great.
That's wonderful.
In front of me, I've just got tons of Meltdown Inspector articles pulled up. Oh boy, howdy! It's been.
Oh.
Yeah, we'll jump into that. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, one thing. Tom, you haven't shared with us, or are your news items strictly?
Oh no, no, I got some news items.
Okay.
So I have some related to that, and I have a few ones. So we'll start off. Well, we'll just go. I have mostly positive news. Like, all right. Really good stuff.
Wow.
Beside, with the exception of the Spectre Meltdown, it was a positive news couple weeks.
Good.
So, fiscal earnings over at our friends at not just Red Hat. We talked about Red Hat last time. Ubuntu made money.
Mm. Really?
And so, yes.
You know, that didn't get a – I must have missed that.
It didn't get the fanfare. It didn't. Their 2017 fiscal year, $126 million.
What was it on?
Their headcount, that's their total earnings.
Oh, okay.
And their headcount grew from 496 to 566 people. So, and they managed to net a net profit, though, of $2 million. But that's fine. They mostly did focus a lot on adding and expanding the company. So they made money at all is wonderful in the open source world.
Now,
so.
I wonder if someone paid them $2 million to get rid of Unity.
Well,
the good news is
so negative, Phil.
Yes. Well, the good news is one of the things they did was, and this was a bit of controversial, getting rid of Unity. They focused on all core functionality of the OS and less of the fluff stuff. And they actually had a lot of developers on UI and Unity specifically, and they did kind of repurpose them, I believe, into the company elsewhere, because that was a big controversy about it. Because it was one of those things, like, they just really went all in on this Unity thing, and everyone's like, there's Gnome and KDE. Like, there's already a competitive marketplace for the two big ones, and there's plenty of smaller ones out there for interfaces. Why do you guys do this interface that doesn't fit the category of either, and you spend a lot of time and money on it? So,
all right. Well, now I'm sitting next to Phil, so of course his skepticism and stuff just kind of jumped over to me. So, my question is: those numbers, are those GAAP or non-GAAP numbers? You know, generally accepted accounting principles.
Oh, I believe those are GAAP.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe those GAAP. There's a link in the article.
It's non-GAAP. No, sometimes creative accounting.
Well, here's the problem. They're South American too, aren't they?
Oh.
So I don't know where their guidelines fall for accounting.
I don't think so. You mean South African?
South African,
yes.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Tom
was wrong again. Just note
I was
that.
Wrong. No. So, yeah. We are in the New York Times. Well, not us. Linux.
Oh.
But that's still important. So New York Times did an article. Let's talk about Linux. Take a look at it. And that's interesting. It's not a deep dive article, of course, and you wouldn't expect New York Times to have a deep dive article. But the fact that they're putting it in the New York Times is an interesting topic for me because, you know, it's the year of the Linux desktop, 2018.
Oh, of course it is.
Just like 2017 and 2016. We're going to be the 2%. I guess this is a little bit less of a positive story, but it did at least got them some fanfare. But it's a lesson in idiocy here. Mozilla and Mr. Robot. So if you didn't know, Firefox recently pushed an add-on called Looking Glass and carrying no description other than "My reality is different than yours." While it was a benign marketing campaign by the company, users assumed they had downloaded malware. This was a weird thing because this is where it's a lesson in stupidity. They didn't even get paid for this. They decided someone thought Mr. Robot was cool, so they inserted a line from the Mr. Robot TV series into Mozilla like it was a sponsored ad, where it's stupid as it wasn't sponsored. They didn't even get paid for it. Like, you screwed up your brand, you screwed up trust with the users, and you didn't even make money. Like, we'd at least think if you were corporate shilling, we'd say, well, you know, you probably needed a few dollars, and we could somehow rationalize it. Now we just think you're stupid. So that's my take on it, at least, going, if you're going to sell out, get paid, or you're dumb. Just, sorry, Mozilla. Good news is they did release 5704. Release notes include the Spectre mitigation. So that's in there. And I think that was it. Oh, this is just something amusing. I like Linux gaming, which related to, and maybe our listeners want to throw some feedback on this, I made friends with a YouTuber that is called the Linux Gamer. Neat guy. He's been doing some other podcast shows, and I thought he's willing to do an interview. It'd be remote, but he could just talk about the status of gaming and Linux. That's his entire focus. He has a YouTube channel. That's all he does is review Linux gaming, which is so much. That is still, anytime I do distro reviews or talk about stuff on my YouTube channel, I would switch to Linux, but I game, which is exactly why my wife's laptop does not run Linux and why she has so much problem with their editing. She plays games. The games don't work well, don't work in Linux, but there are alternatives, not to the game that my wife plays, but so that's one topic, and the last one is sshtron.zach LATTA.com.
Oh, SSH Tron is tons of fun. I've had that in my bash aliases for some time now.
You can play. I'm not familiar with it.
Tron is the little game, like it was called Snakes forever ago.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Snakes. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you can play it right in SSH, and it's fun.
It's four players, and you get red, green, blue, and yellow.
Yep.
And everyone's got their quote-unquote light cycle, driving around, drawing different pipe characters on the screen.
Yes.
It's really goofy, but it's a good time killer.
It's a good time. It's a good time.
There's a YouTube video of it. You can go out and watch it.
All right. Yeah, right. Or you can just SSH in. And if you do install Bash on Windows, you can join us Linux folks. And eventually you should just format your computer in Linux so you don't have to install Bash on Windows.
There you go.
So back to Conical, the corporation?
Yeah.
It's based out of the UK.
Oh, UK. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That I didn't... Yeah, I don't think it's...
I think Shuttleworth... Yeah. Maybe he's South African.
He is.
Yeah.
I know he is. I just assumed that's where the company was based as well.
There you go.
So here comes all the notes on the meltdown.
Well, and before we do, I want to mention that, and this because this article appeared in Extreme Tech, and it appeared on December 22nd, which I think predates the well, as far as the public dissemination of this information, DARPA and the University of Michigan team up to build unhackable chip.
Yeah,
and so I what kind of cracked me up about it is the fact that this came out I think several days before, and I don't know if these guys were aware of it, but they you know, they're talking about software and hardware models as far as trying to hack stuff and not hack stuff. So I think it'll be kind of interesting to see how this progresses, especially in light of the recent news about Spectre and Meltdown. But I found the article kind of interesting, especially because they're working with DARPA, you know, those crazy spooks, those government spooks. So that's all I got.
All right. So the analogies and things like that. So this is where I have it typed so I can actually read from a script. And some of this I pulled because the Register is where I pulled a little bit of this information from. They had a pretty good write-up, but then I rephrased a little bit. But if you're not familiar with the way processors work, which very, very few people are, turns out they are as rare as Linus is. The people who design these processors are also a rare breed of people because microarchitecture processors become extremely complicated. And one of the ways to make them more efficient is speculative. This has been around for a little while, but it's speculative execution. So to reduce the idle time in most modern chips, speculate about future instructions while processing present ones. The process known as speculative execution. If they guess right, they save time. If they guess wrong,
You
lose time. It's just an error in prediction. You're no worse off because it was done at an idle cycle. Spectre attacks dupe the processor into making guesses about future instructions that wouldn't otherwise be allowed, therefore gaining access to privileged information within the kernel address space or data running in those processes. Basically, those designing affected processors didn't anticipate this scenario. They built a fence around the execution engines, were satisfied with the security and protection until Google Project Zero researchers and a few other experts brought a ladder to the party and broke it all. So, in short, the speculative execution, things happen in series because of the way programs work. So if I'm rendering something, I usually probably repeat the same instruction over and over again so the processor can predict that next instruction set will probably be very similar to the previous one so it can make guesses about it. It's like if I said A, B, C, D, E, F, you would just, in your head, finish G because it's an assumption. Oh. Oh, yeah.
Yes, that is called branch prediction.
Branch prediction.
RaspberryPi.org has a really, really easy to understand layman's article about Spectre and Meltdown. At least from my perspective, it was super, super helpful. I did read the Google Project Zero README, but then I'm not a microprocessor developer. I don't understand how some of those things work. I plug the computer in, and then, well, some electrical magic happens.
Yeah.
And then I can run my operating system on top of it. But Spectre and Meltdown, for those who haven't heard, and if you haven't heard, huh, well, you're in for a treat. They are side-channel attacks. And just like Tom was saying, process is run, and as you use your computer, other processes are running, and they can read memory.
They should be running in isolation,
Full reign of the memory. In other words, yes. Are they just limited to certain address registers?
Ideally, all the processes running in parallel, you should not be able to read from the memory tables. Now, mm-hmm. this is why we have address space randomization, and of course, FreeBSD started the trend of kernel space, the KMLR?
Kessler, yes.
Kessler, the kernel address space randomization systems. And the idea is these processes may not know of each other. They may run individually and not have shared memory. That way, mm-hmm. my password manager doesn't get to talk to my browser. Well, that's where this goes wrong. They found JavaScript implementations they were able to run inside of a browser. Now, they're doing this by deferring the memory timing issues. They can defer what's in memory based on the time. It's very much like the Rowhammer one we talked about a few months back, where you're determining the timing to make assumptions about what's in the memory, and are determining the time it takes to get something done, whether or not the branch prediction was a certain thing or not. It's amazing, but it seems like it wouldn't work. But it does work because of how fast processors go. You can aggregate the data very quickly because they're running at so many gigahertz, so many mm-hmm. parallel processes at once. I'm able to defer that information out. And it's just it's a hell of a mathematical equation to be able to think that way and be able to put that together.
Absolutely. So there are kernel patches that are currently available for Meltdown.
Yes.
But as far as Spectre, the kernel developers are still working on this.
Yes.
So Spectre isn't going to be just a kernel or BIOS or firmware fix. All software is going to have to be patched as well that uses high-resolution timers.
Yes. And actually, they poison the high-resolution timers in the browser. That's what Mozilla and Chrome have both done, is drop a little bit of randomness into the high-resolution timer. That creates – it breaks their ability to use that high-resolution timing attack. So it's a really interesting way they had to do it. They just kind of poison it because high-resolution timers seem like a good idea for speed. But this is where the speed comes in. And I actually pulled this from Pharonix, and because their initial talk was that we're going to see 20 to 30% hits – they're actually seeing a little bit less. And my speculation as to why, maybe Phil thinks about this a little bit differently, but when you start running stuff like Docker, you already kind of break speculation because you're running so many processes once on one processor, especially when you have a hypervisor, and then inside that hypervisor, you have Docker containers running. So the processor has a hard time predicting what's going to happen next because so many things are happening in parallel at once. So I think that's why they're seeing less of an issue, because it already couldn't use branch prediction to do as good of a job as it did on these single use cases. That's my guess on it, because I noticed when I read through the kernel developer logs, they were testing it on like their own Core i7 CPUs in their desktop environment. And what they would do is they would apply the kernel patch. They would do a benchmark, apply the kernel patch, do a benchmark, and go, wow, we've seen this 20% hit. But you're running a processor. Think about a data center, or even my own Zen hypervisor here. I'm running 7 virtual machines that have their own virtualization stuff going on inside of them, and I have a 32-core processor running. So how good is branch prediction at that point?
The hit is very workload dependent.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. if you're running a database, you will see a different performance hit than just running web nodes, for instance. Right.
Yeah, the database performance is the one I've seen. But if, for example, that database is dedicated in pulling up a lot of processor power, you see a hit. But if mm-hmm. you're like some of the machines that are just running a diversity in all the databases at once, branch prediction couldn't have helped to begin with. So anytime where branch prediction helps, and that becomes a very per-server use case, because does that server have one dedicated database on it, or does it have a multitude anyways? So they're like, yeah, we didn't see a hit because it already couldn't predict what was going to happen next because these 10 users have 30 processes under each user, so we've got 300 processes that we can't branch predict anyways. It's cache timing, almost. It's kind of the same concept. It's helpful if you have a workload that can be predicted and loaded in a cache. If you are running unpredictable workloads, you don't get any benefit from it.
Now, for Meltdown, the Linux kernel 4.14.12 that was recently released, I'm getting this information from Croa www.greg.com, which is the blog from Greg Croa Hartman. He builds the kernel and releases it.
Haven't heard that name for a while.
Yeah.
Very, very nice guy. I got to meet him and shake his hand.
Oh wow, great.
So 4.14.12, if your OS can get that kernel, you should be running at least that. If you have boot problems, run 4.14.13.
And a quick way to find out is, isn't it uname space dash a.
Yep.
We'll tell you the Linux kernel you're running.
So there's also backports being done to 4.4 and 4.9, but what happens if you are in RHEL world? They're still running on the 3 kernel.
Oh.
Mm. So backports might not happen. I know that we did another round of updates at work, but there was a whole bunch of work for this page table instruction, I think it was called, PTI, from a patch set called Kaiser. And Spectre and Meltdown come out of this old patch set.
Wow. It's crazy. Yes. I'm also going to leave in the show notes a warning. There's profanity. I'm not going to read it on the show, but Linus...
He drops the F bomb?
No, just the S word, which is shocking. Okay. He drops there. Here's his. We'll just read the non-swearing part. But a competent CPU engineer. This is his reply to Intel and this happening. A competent, and he puts little asterisks around it. CPU engineer would fix this by making sure speculation doesn't happen across protection domains. Maybe even if L1I dollar sign. That is the keyed CPL. I think somebody inside of Intel needs to really take a long, hard look at their CPUs and actually admit that they have issues instead of writing PR blurbs that say everything works as designed. The rest of it, he goes into other details in here. So
sure.
Oh, at the end, he does sign it. Please talk to management because I really expect two possibilities. Intel never tends to fix anything, or these workarounds should have a way to disable them. Which one of the two is it, Intel? I mean, he's...
Well, their stock took a hit.
Yes, and one guy managed to sell all the stocks as if he knew something.
Oh, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Tom, because I saw that last week. Yeah. So the CEO of Intel sells a bunch of stock.
Yes.
Was it a week before, a couple weeks?
2 weeks before.
Yeah, before this went public.
I've read that was an automated trade, but...
Who set it up?
Yes. Well, it's an automated trade because
before the end of the year,
you and Mary can clarify this if I'm wrong about it, because I'm not an SEC person. But if you have stock in a company you work for, you have to file with the FCC that you're going to do a trade. So you put in a trade order that has to be audited by the FCC to let them know that you plan to do a sell of your company's stock. You have to file it ahead of time. It has to go through a review process. And his answer is it was done before the release. The problem is, if you look at the Project Phi, June of 2017 is when this bug report was filed. Mm. They went way longer than a 90-day filing because of the severity of the bug and the problems with it. So they gave Intel and other processor manufacturers a big heads up. 6 months is how long this has been known about. So they gave it a 6-month instead of a 90-day release. So this was well known inside of Intel as of June of 2017. So yes, he did file it early. It was an automated trade based on an earlier filing because you have to file it ahead of time. That's the same excuse the Equifax people gave, who also...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I have little faith in our government's ability to actually prosecute or SEC's authority to... they have the authority to it. Will they have the willingness or desire? I don't know. That goes off the rails and out of discussion. But, yeah, there was plenty of prior knowledge. There was also a lot of prior knowledge because a lot of these kernel changes were happening without notes. This was a bunch of speculation. There's a write-up on I should probably find the link. It was a Python guy that wrote – he was trying to reverse engineer what the kernel changes were because they lacked notes other than it was for a security change and a note to be added after the release of the bug. This is actually a really interesting thing that happens in open source. People try to figure out bugs by looking at the code changes that are being submitted because those changes can't relate to the CVE because the CVE is not published. It is now, And they put the notes in later, but this is an interesting way open source is developed. You can still develop in the clear. We're not saying why we're changing this code. We're saying that it needs to be changed. And that's what was going on. So a few people tried reverse engineering it and looking at how it was. And they were making guesses as to what the changes were coming. So we know it was out there. These guys at Intel were very on the up and up on it because there's no way you can't predict that your stock's not going to get slapped. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a mess.
Okay.
What else? I don't think I had too much else on it. The guys.
Do you guys maybe I zoned out for a second while everybody was talking, but what is the difference between Spectre and Meltdown?
Meltdown the processors? Only affects Intel, and it's a more. You can get higher levels of access through it because you can manipulate the way the branch prediction works. And versus the other one is a more local. It has to run on the machine directly, and it's less of a threat, but it's a problem. Like Phil said, with the Spectre, there's a lot of programming things need to be changed.
Yeah, Spectre is such a problem because JavaScript is an attack vector. So just going to a website with a non-patched browser, granted your CPU will spin up and start just chugging through cycles, people who don't patch are vulnerable to that.
And sysadmins who use browsers on servers.
Oh, jeez.
They do. These people exist. I'm sorry, but they do, and they create hell for people, all the other people who are real sysadmins. Go, why did the previous guy that you just fired because your system got pwned do this? We don't know why he did it.
Well, I'll tell you why they do it. They do it because sometimes vendors who install things who have systems and various software components that get installed on customers' systems need to go in remotely and access things. Sometimes, depending on who's going into access, like a project manager such as myself, when I'm trying to check and see how the system, was it installed properly? Am I pulling up research results, et cetera? It's done in a browser. That's why it sometimes happens.
Well,
that's a good point.
And we had we just had a security. Well, not we solved the incident. They created the incident. My clients bought a very large program to run their business. They paid like $25,000 in licensing fees for this program. So you're not talking about something that they bought for $99 online. They bought an enterprise level program to run their enterprise company. This was the solution the company did. They wanted us to give them admin privileges, which we kind of had to. Whatever there, the server's dedicated to them. Except for it is a file server as well. They just opened up C drive as the share, the entirety of the C drive. The D drive was where they were instructed by my email to install the software, and I created a share for them. The installer just opened up the C drive because he couldn't get it to work and left it that way.
Jeez.
Yeah, we fixed it and moved it, but like including they could just – everyone had read-write access to the Windows directory on the server. Mm. It was not put into production. We solved it before it was put into production. But I almost want to rant, like, really? You guys are a company that services large corporations and charge lots of money, and this is how your guys messed up my server. So on the topic, 4Onix, PHORONIX, I have a link for the show notes. They actually do a whole series of tests on desktops and servers and Docker performance. They're doing a whole rundown of before and after tests. They have an entire lab they built, so they're publishing the finite details of what it's like to have it patched and unpatched kernels and what the speed differences are. And they break down a lot of detail for people that are really interested in that. So they've been releasing like two or three times a day updated reports for different programs running and everything. So it's really clever. They said the Docker ones are more promising. As in they don't seem to have as much of a hit, but they do show database performance, and encrypted file systems take a hit because of the CPU load it takes to run encrypted file systems.
Oh, so, sure.
And that's something that lends itself very heavily to branch prediction, because if I decrypt the first block, the next blocks were probably going to use the same instruction set, so branch prediction probably works really, really well for encrypted file systems. So breaking branch prediction in there does mean you see a performance hit on CPUs. Or hard drives because of the CPU load. So, but yeah, they're got a lot of testing they're doing. Because people ask me to do testing. I'm like, I'm not qualified. I am not educated. These guys are already doing it. And they're open source lovers who they have their whole testing process is broken down as well.
Veronix is fantastic.
They are just a great resource for things like that. So I'm going to leave them. I'll leave the testing to the experts over at them. And there's more testing probably. I mean, this was just this morning. I think they released this one. So by tomorrow, they'll probably have more. So my link in the show notes will just go to them for, for the testing.
Right. So, and one thing, maybe I, like, again, I was trying to follow it, the whole thing. I don't know whether I'm just foggy today, but
it's a mess.
I don't know if you're talk about it, but the real world, like what people should be worried about and how this affects
make
people.
Make sure you update, make sure you get your security updates.
Yeah, yeah. Make sure you install your security updates. But what it actually does is, so, I mean, we talked about it, it can access memory space from other programs. And what you should be worried about is that in the memory space is where your decrypted username and passwords are held, or you know, or other sensitive information that you don't want. You know, your like you said, your LastPass can be running is a separate memory space than your web browser. But if you hit a website that has a JavaScript running this exploit, then they would be able to try to figure out where LastPass is decrypted its blob to, and then be able to get your username and passwords.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's really important for you to go through and update your computers.
Especially the browser, because that's for the consumer, in the majority of people, that is the one of the huge attack vectors. For example, on my machines, I run my own virtual stack, and I'm running all the software in there. So it's less likely because I trust all the – as long as I trust all the software that's running in my virtual server stack, it's less of a concern. I still patch. I still keep everything up to date. Less likely of an attack vector. My laptop – running a JavaScript that someone embedded on a website and my password manager being on there, huge security risk. That's where the threat model comes from.
And not only just passwords, but
anything.
These could be VM escapes as well.
Yes.
So you could leave the confines of your virtual machine and get into another virtual machine. Let's say if you're on shared hosting, such as Amazon or Google Compute, and then you're in someone else's domain.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So that's what don't think that you have your VM host is secure that and you don't worry about your guests, the VM guests. You got to make sure all your VM guests are secured and locked down also.
For our Windows listeners, I will comment on how to mitigate it. Install Linux. No. For whatever reason,
I was thinking that.
If you're running Windows 10, they patched it immediately. If you're running by the time you listen to this podcast, well, this Tuesday, if you're running the previous versions of Windows that are still supported, which is 7 and Vista, you will get an update on Tuesday unless, and I'll say this, unless, and this also goes to Windows 10 people who won't get the update. If you're running a third-party antivirus, it's a mixed bag of which ones are blocking the update and which ones are allowing it, which is causing a big aggravation. For whatever reason, lots of the enterprise antivirus companies are blocking this update for reasons unknown. Microsoft's got a blurb about it. But if you're – and I've actually recommended this to a lot of people. Don't bother running third-party ones because they're all equally awful. So just run the Windows Defender. And when Microsoft was actually hats off to them, is they patched quickly on this upon release, at least for Windows 10. They're showing their you should be on Windows 10 by waiting till Tuesday to release the rest of the updates. But updating your browser is probably your biggest threat to mitigate is make sure your browser's up to date and don't use Edge. I don't know when Edge is getting an update, but Firefox is up to date. Google Chrome, I'm looking at you. I think they said not until January 23rd. So if you're not on Canary, if you're not running one of the betas, I believe
another week or so.
It's about a week before they're going to have it implemented in the production one. I don't know if they've upped the timeline on it, but last I checked, I think it was January 23rd was their predicted release date.
All right.
All right. We've had a meltdown over it. We speculated enough.
Yeah.
Right.
Let's make this a Spectre ghost of the past. Moving on. But I think good knowledge, it is a big topic, so.
Definitely.
Oh, last thing I will add. Kernel, this is our first iteration. These kernel hits and things like that, the speed problems. This is the first iteration. Undoubtedly, someone's going to look at it and go, oh, yeah, if I move this over here, it may get faster. So these speed hits are we're going on the side of caution and security, getting the tinfoil hats on. But later we may go, we can still optimize better by doing something else.
Absolutely.
So we will see improvements like we always do with code. The first 10,000 lines are always the worst. Every iteration gets better.
Good.
That's right.
Yep. We got music?
Music. Oh.
Oh. We will. We
Tony, will. I think right. that hat is just a little too tight.
Maybe.
Tony's got a Red Wings vest.
Well, yeah.
I actually like it, though, because it's...
Actually,
you
know, I think...
You look very stylish over there with your shades of green.
Yeah. I stayed up too late watching TV last night.
Me too. Oh,
okay. That Traveler's show on Netflix. Yeah.
I was at a party. Yeah.
I love that there's more sci-fi coming out. It's making me so happy.
I watched the movie Bright. I thought it was really cool.
Yes.
It was really cool.
Yeah.
Super cyberpunk. And then elves and orcs. Oh, it hit the right spots for me.
You take Lord of the Rings up, and makes it
They signed up
day.
For part two. They're going to make another one. But I think it's a prequel. But I believe Will Smith's going to be in it.
Hey, that's all right. I just want to see more of that world.
Yes. There was people complaining, and this is my little rant on it. People complaining about they didn't give backstory. They drop you in a world with humans, orcs, and that with zero backstory because it's modern day times. But we got orcs and elves and fairies.
Yeah.
And someone's like, "Well, there's no backstory." And
it
I'm
must
like,
"Be in Iceland." Well, yeah. Have all those little people. You know, like.
But it fit a good narrative. The story was engaging. The story was it was an action movie. It was a buddy cop movie. So there is some things like that with these couple added twists. And then sometimes I don't think it needs backstory. It just they drop me in a world. I get enough information so I can follow the storyline. I am entertained by it, and therefore I liked it. That's if you picked it apart because you didn't get a backstory. Well, go write one. I don't know. Not everything needs a backstory of how the car got there. Just be happy they're in the car together. And that story's not about the car. It's about the life of them together.
Yeah. All right. So I did find music.
Oh, good.
All right. So let's do the...
The outgoing music for this week's show.
All right. So the outgoing music is I found it on cchits.net. And we've talked a little bit about it in the past, where it's kind of like a voting system that people can do for Creative Commons music.
Okay.
And this one is number one for this week.
Can we vote, or is it too late?
but it's called "Show Me What You Got" by AY-14ICE.
I don't care. you got, hey, show me what you got.
Before we chop up the show, or before Tom chops up the show, I misspoke. So the Kaiser patch that I had mentioned, Kaiser was actually a fix for Meltdown, and it came out of Austria from a group of researchers called TU Graz. So I just wanted to mention that, and also when I said PTI, it stands for page
Pardon
table.
The interruption. Oh.
Page table isolation, not page table instruction.
Oh.
So, sorry about that.
So don't send any feedback on that. We know it.
I fact checked myself. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Phil. Because you know I would not have known that.
So we've come to the end of the show.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. So you've been listening to episode 262.
Are you asking me or telling me?
I remembered this time.
Okay. The Specter of a Meltdown.
Yeah. This is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
Phil Parada.
And Tom Lawrence.
See you next time.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.